AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 235 for March 28th. Ralph Gilles lets the Hellcat out of the bag. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. So we're kicking off today's show in non-sunny, rainy and cold Southern California because Gary and I are out in the San Diego area to drive the new Honda Fit. And so
I'm glad it's got warmth inside those cars because it is friggin' cold out here, that's for sure. But it is a nice car, nice package.
Nice package. There's an embargo. We'd love to give you our driving impressions. Honda would shoot us if we did that. But I want to talk about the packaging of this car because I'm really impressed by it.
You are impressed by it. And I think it's important to say, if we look at the market, that Honda's convinced that, you know, this is a very important growing market for subcompacts. And driving around out here, seeing gas prices well over $4 a gallon, I mean, for regular. And, you know, you got to believe that people are going to become more interested in smaller cars going forward.
They could be. I mean, gas prices are high right now. We'll see what happens in the longer run. But getting back to the packaging of the car, what I find amazing is that the gas tank is actually under the front seats. The gas tank is down here, and that really opens up the back seat area and the cargo area for the car. And, you know, Honda's referring to this as packaging magic, and I kind of agree with them.
Right.
I really like the interior.
Right, because if you think about a car, that the percentage of a gas tank for a car that is this small takes up a whole lot of room, so most OEMs position it back behind the rear seat area. So by putting it low and in the middle, you gain back space.
And that's not new to the Fit. The Fit's had this before, but now they've even got a lower profile gas tank.
Right.
Which gives you a higher H point in the car and a bunch of other benefits. But, you know, if you're right, and if these subcompact cars are really going to sell a lot more, people need more versatility in them. I mean, they may be subcompact on the outside, but
right,
they need to be roomier inside.
Sure.
And I would say this car might be class leading.
Yeah, and I mean, because the amount of roominess just sitting in it, I mean, neither of us are very tall, but were we tall, or were we wearing hats like Abraham Lincoln, it would not be a problem at all. I mean, there is a lot of room in that car in terms of headroom and shoulder room, leg room. I just find it almost to be mid-size, or maybe even better than mid-size, because I think that, you know, as the designers and engineers who were working on this, they were saying to themselves, gee, how do we make a car that isn't a little box that people are going to just force themselves into? And as a result of that, I think it's a very comfortable package.
It is. So in a couple of weeks' time, we'll be able to tell you a whole lot more of the pricing, the fuel economy, and our driving impressions. But we wanted to just give you a little bit of a taste of what the new Honda Fit's like. And so why don't we go to the studio right now?
Magically go back to the studio, where it'll be warmer.
And it is magic, and it is warmer.
Right on both counts.
So here we are in the studio again. We've got a Chrysler 200 in the studio because the new Chrysler 200, Ralph Gilles is coming on the show later on. But we also have Frank Marcus, technical editor from Motor Trend. Thanks for joining us again.
Thrilled to be here as usual.
Have you been in the Fit?
I have not been in the Fit yet. I go next Tuesday.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the last wave.
Right, right.
You couldn't talk about
Actually,
it.
Actually, no, April 8th. It's a little ways off.
You couldn't talk about it anyway, so.
That's right. So who cares?
Yeah, that's right.
But I have always loved that car. Any of those tall seating package vehicles end up being packaging miracles. It is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a tall car, but it doesn't look as tall as the old model did. The old model was kind of goofy. It had an overly large greenhouse area.
Yeah.
And it looked almost a little tipsy, top-heavy kind of a thing. The new one, not at all. So it's a good styling job. Gary, you were pointing out, too, the Honda Civic, the bigger brother of the Fit, as it were. is now the number.
All the dimensions, of the interior dimensions of the.
Point that out, because that's very interesting.
I don't know if we can talk about that.
Well, you and I talked about it, yeah. But not on camera.
I know.
No, we can talk about it.
Impressions are the only embargo, right?
It's the driving impressions, the fuel economy rating, and the pricing. Because
yeah.
The car's been on sale in Japan for months now. They can't embargo that part of it.
No, when I was talking about the interior size, and I had this feeling when I sat in the back seat, it was really quite roomy, and I thought, this is bigger than a Civic. And so I went and looked at the numbers.
Well, first you asked the Honda people, and they sort of mumbled something like,
there was that. And sure enough, that the interior volume for the Fit is bigger than the interior volume for the Civic.
You are talking to an idiot savant on packaging here, because I did do a stretch at Chrysler in packaging, and that is a question of you've got shoulder room in Civic, and you've got headroom in the... So, and when those numbers, depending on how they go, you can get a larger number, but the Fit is much narrower. You know, that's...
Right.
So it is, you're trading headroom, legroom, and legroom goes up when you pull the chair off the floor, too. I mean, if you're sitting up here, my leg is pretty comfortable no matter what. If I'm down here now, suddenly, if I don't have enough room here, you know, my leg's not comfortable. So those tall package cars
higher,
are usually comfortable.
Higher is better in terms of roominess.
Yeah.
And comfort, because now you're getting good thigh support.
Sure.
You're not sitting on your tailbone.
Sure. You remember the Festiva? That was another one. 6'5" people could drive those tiny Festivas comfortably because it was tall and chair-high seats. So.
If you wanted to.
Yeah. A killer ice racing car nowadays.
Festiva.
Oh, yeah, that's what you want.
Doesn't have enough power to spin the wheels.
Right, and those little tiny tires, you know, that's the hot setup for ice racing.
On saying. Ice.
If you can't find a Fiesta, the old Ghia Fiestas back in the day, yeah, those are really super great, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I found interesting is when the Civic came out, it was panned, and rightfully so. It was a step down from the prior model, but as Gary's pointing out here...
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Honda is really emphasizing is the fact that individuals buy their cars rather than selling fleets, and therefore they're saying they're better residual values. And so it turns out that, according to IHS, that the Honda Civic was the number one car purchased in California last year.
Beating out the Prius.
Prius had been historically, but it was sort of interesting that, you know, Consumer Reports comes up all the time when people are talking about cars. And when this generation Civic came out, the 2012 model, Consumer Reports wrote, the redesigned 2012 Honda Civic LX scored too low on Consumer Reports testing for to be recommended. Let that sink in for a minute. It's quite a fall. That's what they wrote, okay? And I mean, and everybody roundly criticized that car. And it's sort of interesting how quickly Honda reacted to that and did that, you know, more than a mid-cycle refresh to take care of those
It is
problems.
Quite a lot better. In its class, though, packaging, strangely enough, is not a strong suit there. It is one of the smallest in that class. We just rounded that whole class up, and it hasn't aired yet, so I can't tell you how it finished up. But cost of ownership, too, took a backseat to the Corolla. That one had a slightly better overall cost of ownership. It was good.
And how do you explain it going to be the number one retail car in California?
Well, there you go. I mean, the Corolla wasn't... We didn't have a full year of the new Corolla to compare with, I don't think. So that
You might be right. No, we haven't.
But what happened? What happened to the Prius, though? I mean, why would Prius not be as popular in California as it's historically been? Everyone has one?
Well, you know, what we've talked about on the show is it's late in its life cycle now. But I'm telling you, I've been tracking this since about November last year. Sales of the Prius are dropping fast. Fast.
And you can't get those Hove Lane stickers anymore for them, right?
No.
So
those are only for plug-ins,
right.
Pure electrics, or CNGs. So.
And only because, like, the plug-in hasn't had its... Because I think there's a certain volume of them, and then done.
Goes away,
and that's just new enough that it hasn't used it up yet, so...
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
But it's quite a change, it would seem, that, you know, you'd think that there'd be more of that sort of activity in buying that car, not a decreasing number. But
if you track hybrids, just hybrids overall, they're weakening fast. Pure EVs are growing fast, but the numbers are inky-dinky. Plug-ins are growing fast, but the numbers are inky-dinky. So I'm not sure what's going on there yet. I haven't And we'll need a few more months of sales to figure it out.
I'll tell you, a hybrid I wish they'd bring is the Fit, which, you know, was Car of the Year in Japan when it came out in September, because that has a pretty cool system. But so far, no word on that one.
Yeah, why wouldn't they do that?
I don't know.
That's strange. And they're keeping the old Fit in production for the EV version.
Oh, right.
And I can't believe that's going to last very long. But
it doesn't seem sensible, but unless all... Well, they probably wouldn't, because they're going to build the new Fit in the new plant in Mexico. So presumably they're keeping the tooling and whatnot for the old Fit in Japan, and perhaps the EV package is all done there.
Probably.
So it would maybe not make sense to bring it over. But how many are they going to build? I mean, isn't that a...
Oh, it's like a it's thousand. Like
a, isn't it a compliance car?
Yeah, it's a California car, you know, to comply with California.
Mm-hmm.
What I still can't get any info out of Honda on is that the Fits sold in Canada for the last couple of years have been sourced out of China. And Honda does not want to talk about this at all. And I'm just curious, you know, were the Canadians even aware? Was Honda able to measure any kind of quality difference or anything like that?
Do they have the rules? The window sticker has to say it came from China and everything?
I don't know. Don't know. I'll bet not. You know, you could probably only tell by the VIN. But, I don't know. But Honda, they'll admit, yeah, they came from China, but they won't tell you anything about them. So.
Hmm.
Go figure.
Well, Mercedes always says a Mercedes is a Mercedes no matter where it's made. Honda, they would tell you the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
You know, look, when the first Accord was built in America, that was the big question.
Yeah.
You know, will an American one be as good as a Japanese one?
Because that was not the case with the Westmoreland Volkswagen.
You noticed, eh?
We own two of those.
Oh, jeez.
Well, speaking of Mercedes, Frank and I drove the new Sprinter today.
Yes, we did, together, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, what did you guys think? What's new?
Four-cylinder. And the big question was, can that thing, 3,500 series, 11,000, 12,000-pound GVW with a four-cylinder diesel for real?
What was in there before? A six, right?
And you can still get the six for $910 extra. But you get a seven-speed automatic, and the extra ratios take care. Yeah, it felt just as sprightly off the line. Now, we didn't try filling the back up with depleted uranium or anything and sampling it then, but it felt quite peppy and... Got right up to highway speed, no problem, quiet, you know. That's a killer van.
Well, yeah, it is if you're a contractor. Are they trying to push this as a people mover, too?
Well, they're 15% passenger.
Yeah, really? They're 60%. But is that shuttle run kind of stuff?
Well, it's 60% is for the trades, right? And they were saying the trades range from plumbers to
anything.
I mean, it's right across the board. And but I, you know, I thought it was interesting is the fact that the Freightliner Sprinter and the Mercedes Sprinter, with the exception of the front fascia, are exactly the same. I mean, they admit they're exactly the same, and they cost the same price, exactly the same price. And but they were, you know, I was like, well, who buys the Freightliner rather than buying the Mercedes? And they said, well, some municipalities decide that they think that the Freightliner would be
smells bad to have Mercedes.
So you don't want to see the police paddy wagon roll up with a big
three-pointed star
on the front of it. Yeah, so the Freightliner is, they openly admitted they're the exact.
And they're all expensive.
Exact same vehicle.
Oh yeah,
the ones we were driving were $40,000-$50,000 vehicles.
Ouch.
You know.
Yeah.
Oh, that one was closer to 60.
Yeah.
And that was the crew.
And it's a, you know, rubber floor. And I mean, you know.
Yowza. Where's Ford going to price the Transit? Because that's going to go right head-to-head with that.
Ford isn't up against chicken taxes, for one thing. So they don't have to build them, take them apart, and build them again.
Yeah.
So that cuts down the price a bunch.
I thought the Sprinters were built in the U.S.
They're assembled in the U.S.
They're put back together. They build them completely, do a full quality check, take the drivetrain out, put it on one boat, put the rest of the car on another boat, remarry them in South Carolina.
I thought they were being built.
That's for all the ones
there
that don't have seats in them.
Huh.
Yeah. In the back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. Ford will not face the chicken.
They don't. It'll be cheaper.
So, yeah.
But it's hard to imagine they won't be a little more than the E-Series, because that's really amortized chassis on that thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
I think they amortized that chassis in 1981.
Well, and they upgraded, but it's always a Super Duty pickup type chassis, so they've, you know, they got a lot of volume on that, all those parts.
Mm-hmm.
So, but these things just feel so much more of a piece. And I suspect that the Transit will, too. These kind of more unibody-style, Euro-style vans just seem so much more solid and
well, doesn't
nimble.
Doesn't Ford do a front drive and a rear drive?
And an all-wheel drive, yeah.
Right.
So does,
and,
I
and
think
Mercedes,
Volkswagen does,
they're offering four-wheel drive on this one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But only rear drive, right? No,
it's
no
rear
front.
Drive.
It's a rear drive vehicle,
yeah.
But...
They're going to add four-wheel drive in for 15,
yeah.
Which
but
they've had in Europe.
Ford has two totally separate different chassis. That's how seriously they take that van segment.
Yeah. Although you can't tell from the outside.
No,
so,
right.
Yeah. I think there's a certain class over there that likes the idea that you can saw the car off after the gas tank is under the seats, and literally you can saw it off if it's front-wheel drive and put a big camper or whatever on back there. So.
And there's much more headroom. We changed out driving without leaving the vehicle.
We did stop, though.
So,
yeah.
Good. That, I'm glad, though I sure would have liked to seen it in motion. So another topic, Gary, that you brought up here, there's this new version of the Monte Carlo Rally.
Yeah, this
for electric cars.
Yeah, this is very interesting. So it's called ZEN, Zero Emissions, No Noise. And, you know, I wonder... Would you really want to go see a car race with no noise? It just seems so bizarre to me. And so it was the Citroen C0, the Nissan Leaf, the Renault Zoe, the Mitsubishi iMEV. You know, that's got to do something with those cars. Might as well race them, right? Think City. I didn't know that Think City was still made anymore.
Norway.
Yeah, mostly Norway, right.
Yeah, the VW e-Up, Smart Tesla, and the Peugeot Ion, and of course, our friends at Renault won it all, every category. Just swept the
Zoe.
They could read the street signs easier.
The Zoe beat the Tesla. You know, so what's that about? I mean, I didn't they have, they had like weird categories. It wasn't just pure speed.
Well, it's combined classification, regularity classification, energy consumption classification, auto test classification, and teams classification.
I want to know what the regularity one is.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
That's the time, speed, distance thing, right?
I don't know.
No.
Yeah.
Now, ZEN, there was a company making neighborhood vehicles with that name, right?
Correct.
Does that have anything to do with this organization?
No, it does not. I had to look that up. Yeah. Myself,
no, the FIA is supporting this thing.
Okay.
Because the future will be electric, and so you've got to start racing. And you know, but it's interesting. I mean, you could make the argument that a lot of good automotive technology, I mean, we had Moe's on last week and was talking about, you know, engine technology that has come to automobiles. And so, you know, you got to think that there will be technical developments that come out of this and, you know, find their ways into passenger vehicles that more people buy rather than people who are interested in, you know, zero emissions and no noise. But I just wonder what that might be. Or maybe this is just a spectator sport and, you know, call it good and clean up on that.
Now, for electric cars to sell, they got to be sold, and that's the other topic. You know, this big backlash against Tesla that's coming from dealers in the U.S. saying, "Whoa, whoa, 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 hold the horses here! You cannot go around the dealer franchise network." And so now we're starting to see some politicians backpedal on it. Marco Rubio is leading the charge in favor of Tesla. Rick Perry from Texas, governor, is talking in favor of it. And I guess we're debating whether or not Chris Christie out of New Jersey really is pushing it or not. But there's a move afoot in New Jersey to legalize
it. But, I mean, but Rubio's point was somewhat bigger than just Tesla, because he said he was on CNBC the other morning when this is where this whole thing started. And he said regulation should never be a weapon used by connected and established industry to crowd out innovation and competition. And this is a real world example. And so he was talking Tesla, but he was also talking about Uber, the car sharing. So basically, I watched the CNBC clip, and he was emphasizing the fact that, you know, in the case of Tesla, this is an established car. People like it. It's won all kinds of awards, you know, Motor Trend Car of the Year and on and on and on. And why should they be hobbled in any way, shape, or form in terms of selling their vehicles? So I think that, you know, he's trying to get ahead of the 2016 presidential nomination by taking this position, which is, you know, somewhat, I don't know, libertarian, it would seem, more than Republican.
Good for him. I just presume that his campaign war chest is sufficiently full that he can kiss all the car dealer contributions goodbye, because it sure seems like that's likely. But
yeah, you know, I believe the automakers are going to support the dealers in this fight because, as I keep saying, the Chinese are right around the corner. They're going to come to this market. And if all of a sudden you tell them, ah, no problem, you don't have to go through the franchise system, doesn't that give them a huge advantage when, you know, anywhere from roughly, I don't know, 12% to 18% of the car is the cost of dealer markup. So if you could put that in your pocket, wowza, or use that to lower your car prices. This is why I think you're going to see the established automakers scream bloody murder if Tesla is given this exemption.
Yeah. But as a talking point in an election, you know, how many car buyers have warm, fuzzy, and nostalgic feelings for their dealer? You know, I mean, it's a hateable group in some ways for the person on the street just dealing with them in a lot of cases anyway. Not all. Obviously, the luxury ones quite often really hold your hand and so forth. But I think there's probably, on balance, more negative dealer thoughts out there than positive. So,
but they're very powerful politically.
Absolutely.
Very powerful. So I'm skeptical that, you know, these bills in the legislatures in the states will actually go through. Even though you have governors out there, you know, thumping the podium and talking about how they're all for it, they're not the ones who are going to enact the legislation. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but if the laws are changed at the state level, you know, it'd almost be like a tipping point, a house of cards that, you know, so if Texas does it, New Jersey does it, Florida does it, California hasn't changed the law, but somehow there doesn't seem to be a problem in terms of selling Teslas there.
The California dealers do not like this.
Right. But I mean, but cars are somehow still being sold and you know, through the galleries that they have. So that would put enormous pressure on every other state legislature to want to be with this. So we'll see what happens. In the chat room, JM1NB said the dealership laws were made to protect existing dealers from the parent company they are selling cars for. Since Tesla has no dealers, there is no conflict.
I think he's right, legally, but that's not how it's gone down yet. I agree with that comment, but, you know, so far it hasn't happened that way. And it might just be that you're going to have to take it to some sort of federal level.
And I'll be real eager to see if any Chinese company thinks that it will be able to, from China or wherever, manage that. I have a feeling they're going to go, ooh, no, please, you guys who know what you're doing over there,
well, you know what?
Handle our cars.
You'd be right, Frank, because China has adopted U.S.-style franchise laws.
Yeah.
So it would be very natural for them to do what they've done in China. But somebody could come along and have a huge advantage. Maybe it's not. Maybe the dealers would argue, no, we're the better way of doing it. But my guess is if Tesla gets this, there's going to be others trying for it. Hey, with that, let's take a quick break here. I'm dying to get Ralph Gilles in here and start talking about the Chrysler 200 and a whole bunch of other things. So, Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Hey, before we get going with Ralph Gilles here, we did an Instapoll with the chat room. So, Gary, what do you got there?
All right, so the question was, would you like to see more John and Gary on the road quick hits? 82% said yes. So.
Wow. Uh-oh.
Guess we'll have to go on more car trips,
John. We should have
John.
Never done the first one. Ralph Gilles, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you
Always
here.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah. Hey, you heard us talking about that Honda. Have you ever heard of packaging the gas tank under the front seats?
Yeah, we're really? Very aware of that. It's pretty neat. You know, most people's anxieties of that are out because it's been under the rear seat for years, right? So you're moving it to the front. And that's a pretty efficient car, so it doesn't take all that much space to start with. It's probably 8 gallons or so, maybe 10 gallons.
I want to say if you go back to the Model T days, that's where the gas tank was.
The old Willie's Jeep.
Was it really?
Yes.
But when I was
that was precarious.
Well, that's why it was moved to the back.
Bullets are flying around. You know?
That's why in the as soon as they got sense about why are we putting everybody on top of this thing that could explode? Let's move it to the back at least. And now it's kind of ironic it's being moved forward again.
There's a lot of advances in the cell, the design of the fuel.
Well, it's so very safer thick. The way it's packaged and all. Right.
Polyethylene or something like that.
So. Hey, so we got your new 200 in the studio.
Yeah, the
here.
Company.
I love having cars in the studio.
Yeah, that's cool. It looks good. That velvet red looks pretty good.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's inspired. You ever cut a velvet cake open? Mm. It's got that deep red color. That's that's kind of.
It's a beautiful color.
Yeah, we have this Jim Parker. We call him the color chef. He's like he's got a color kitchen. He keeps drumming up these great colors. You know, it's not just Challengers that get cool colors. Sometimes the mass market vehicles. So
what's your favorite part about that exterior design?
I love the bone line. I mean, it's got a little Virgil Exner in it. You know, that wonderful bone line starts from where the fog lamp emanates all the way down the body side and then terminates in what's an aerodynamic detail, actually. It actually helps us trip the wind off the back of the fascia, but also goes around a little bit. The 300 has it as well, this line that comes back in, kind of gathers the car together. Mm-hmm. But I like the shoulders. You know, it's rare that these kind of vehicles have shoulders, so it plants the vehicles from a rear view. There's this nice broad shoulder that runs down the length of the body side of the vehicle.
And in the rear quarter, you got kind of good depth of draw in the thing, too.
Yeah.
Speaking of shoulders.
Yeah, we push the limits of our stamping team. I mean, really, this car is, it's really... it's designed to look almost European, the details, you know, very well put together. We have laser-brazed roof ditch. I'm really proud of it. It's not something you think about, but very few cars do that at this price point. I don't think anyone does, mostly the high-end European vehicles. So you don't get the wrap joint. You get a beautiful beautiful roof, fit and finish, the mirror. I mean, we probably sweat the mirror probably for 5 months getting it. And we're very proud of it. You know, part I can contribute is aerodynamics. So we're down to 0.27.
Now, you guys got a wind tunnel, right?
Oh, yeah. We've had
is it a full-size?
Full-size wind tunnel, 150 mile per hour, I believe, max speed. And then we've spent probably 3 times more time on this car than any car ever before. So just getting that last little bit.
Now, you got CFD, you know, where you can check out all the aerodynamics on the computer before going in the tunnel.
Computational fluid dynamics for the people that don't know this.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. Usually that's my job.
Yeah, so it gives us a good predictive analysis, but there's nothing like staying in a tunnel with the ink and all that. We still do that. We still use the smoke and the ink. It's that last 2%. You know, it's amazing. That's what we're looking for.
That's where you got to be in the tunnel.
Yeah, and the poor engineers don't get enough credit. Even the underbody of this vehicle is beautiful. Put on a hoist. We're talking about race cars before. It looks like a race car. I mean, everything is covered. Because it's a virtually new platform, we're able to shape the fuel tank, shape the control arms, the way the lines are gathered up under the car. It's really, there's a lot of love equity in this car.
See, I like that because I've loved aerodynamics, you know, in cars since I was a little kid and starting to get into cars. And it's awesome in my book to finally see things like underbody pans, you know, belly pans under the engine compartment, the kind of detail you're talking about, shaping the lower struts and the like to even be more.
You know, I wrench, right? So I've had friends, I have a hoist in my house. I've been changing clutches for friends for years. I noticed the BMWs always had that, you know, because their gas was $6-7 a gallon, right? So now you're seeing that come stateside. And it's cool. It's a little extra work, but it doesn't really cost that much more to do. It's just time.
So is it convenient to you to have that wind tunnel so close to where you guys work?
Yeah, and we use it 24/7. Matter of fact, the energy is a little cheaper at night, so there's a lot of overnight crews. Just keep that place is 24/7. We're always using the wind tunnel.
And so it wasn't a matter you had to ship it to across town to put it in the wind.
In the old days, we would go down to Washington, D.C. and borrow, I forget the name of the tunnel, but we'd go borrow it and rent it. And once in a while, we'd go to GM and ask for the tunnel. But we've had it for now. We've had about over 10 years, so it's paid dividends. Yeah.
Well, like you say, some of these styling details, mm-hmm. I think, are good. And like you're saying, you want more of a clean separation point in the back, but you get a character line out of doing that.
You kind of design it in, and I think the vehicle ends growing some interesting details that over time people understand what that is. Right now it's just a detail, but, you know, as you educate people, like, wow, that's an aerodynamic detail. You know?
And the interior, way more sophisticated than the – I shouldn't even compare it to the old
car. No, it has nothing to do with the old car. And I think, you know, hats off to the interior team. It's something we've been working towards, you know, really wanting to be second to none on the interior and to give people unexpected luxury in this class. I mean, a lot of people, when we took the research clinics, people couldn't place the car. They said, is this a $40,000 car? They had trouble because we didn't tell them what it was. Just look at it. And that was good. It was, you know, and at the time, the new front end didn't correlate to anything they'd seen from Chrysler before, so they didn't know what they were looking at. They thought they were looking at a very expensive European car. Exactly the effect we were wanting. Hmm. So it's all about perceived quality, but it's actual quality, the way parts go together, the material choices. The console, I dare you to feel around the back of the console. It's all finished off. There's no raw edges. The way the console actually slides like a drawer, furniture-grade style bearings, I mean, it really, and that's that second level. You don't notice it when you're in a test drive, but when you own the car for 3-4 months, you go, wow, this thing is really solid, you know? Hmm. And I hope you sell cars through the word of mouth that
way. So how'd you guys get so smart?
I can't say the word, but it's a give a brack, brack, brack. It's putting people that are passionate, because I think car designers, most car designers aren't excited about doing interior, but we hired nothing but interiors experts. And the same thing on engineering. You took into people that were passionate about engineering interiors and put them together. And I forget how big the team is now. It used to be 0 people 6 years ago. Now it's over 100 people dedicated. We used to rely on the supplier to throw it over the wall. Supplier would give us back something. Now we pretty much design it to tool. So it's designed to print and go make that part, and it's engineered by us, so it comes to our standards. And we learned a little bit working with Mercedes back in the day, a lot with Volkswagen and Audi. They have a guy who does nothing but outlets. You know, now we have a person who does nothing but outlets and does nothing but seats and does nothing but all that stuff.
Another thing that Andrew Love told me on the long lead was that in the Daimler days, engineering had all of the responsibility for the product. And, you know, the cost cutting, you know, and whatever. But none of the responsibility for the sales and so forth. And now the marketing people have all that, you profit and loss on everything, and they get to say what it looks like and what, you know, what the product attributes are. So the people that are responsible now have ownership. Mm-hmm. And that makes a big difference.
It does, but I got to believe the biggest difference is just getting the budget to do it right.
Yeah.
I'll bet if you go back to the last generation one, they didn't have the kind of money to spend on the interior you did.
Hats off to Sergio. He put down the gauntlets.
Well, we're seeing that. That's a big change in Detroit. It's not just a Chrysler. I see it at Ford and General Motors, too. And Bob Lutz said this on the show years ago. Yeah. You put $400 more into the interior, and now you don't have to put $4,000 of sales incentives on the hood.
And this vehicle starts at a lower price than the exit vehicle. Think about that.
Wow, did not know that.
The MSRP is 21.7.
Wow.
Without the destination. So wait a minute. I mean, think about that for a second. Now we're
counting on a minute, because you hit a pet peeve of mine.
Yeah.
No automaker in this market should be allowed to quote a price without the destination.
At least we put in the fine print. Come on.
Yeah.
Everybody does it.
No, but General Motors. Give them all the credit. General Motors puts the destination charge. I can't buy it without the destination charge, so don't tell me what the price is
without it. Go to Sterling
Heights.
Maybe you can drive your car to the plant there.
See, but it's an interesting point about
but it's relative.
The $400 on the interior, but you guys just didn't put it in the interior. You made sure that you kept some for the exterior.
Yes.
You know, that mirror.
Yeah.
I mean,
the mirror, the headlamps, the LED fog lamps. I mean, a lot of freedom there. The closures, you know, really, if you look at the way the hood goes into the A-pillar, it's all sealed up. There's no open gaps. I mean, it's all finished off. The tail lamps, LED tail lamps, again, it's not just LED. We actually wanted to outdo ourselves, right? So a continuous, no, you don't get the hot spots. It's beautifully integrated. The tightest lamp-to-lamp gap, I think, in the industry. We're right there with the very best Europeans. So
the idea is make a car that people want to buy, you know, that they won't be saying, all right, how many thousands are you throwing on the hood today? All right, I'll go for it. You know, you got to make people want the car, and that you have to sweat some details and throw some money in.
And guess what? Your residuals will be higher, so now your lease payments go down, the resale, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, all falls into
place. And we try to create a vehicle that would be a little bit timeless. I mean, we got some criticism, hey, does the car stand out enough? But it's designed to look well-built, and that lasts a lot longer than that initial love affair. It's like, that car should look good for another 5, 10, even 15 years.
Well, you guys got to make this car sell well, because that's the one weakness I see at Chrysler right now. Jeeps, no problem. SUVs, no problem. Truck products, no problem. It's the pass cars that just haven't really popped.
Yeah, but we're getting there. I mean, we're putting some, you know, we have more vehicles recommended than ever before. I mean, we learned a lot on the 300, which is recommended, has been recommended for the last couple of years. So a lot of lessons learned on making the customer happy, you know, really listening to it. We're doing more of that now, listening to the customer, looking at past failures and really trying to check all the boxes.
Yeah. With this car, you're dealing with a pretty strong set of competitors.
About as strong as it gets.
So, I mean, how did you guys deal with that? I mean, did you keep your eyes on the Fusion and the Sonata and the Optima?
Of course. I mean, we did a lot of benchmarking. And the Fusion, I remember when the Fusion came at Detroit Auto Show, we all ran over there and looked at it. We were surprised, pleasantly surprised. It was a handsome vehicle, very well packaged, good looking, good aero signature. And we didn't have to adjust. Luckily, we had kind of aimed the right direction. Even the Avalon, a lot of people overlook that vehicle, but it's selling really well.
It is.
It's probably, I think it one day will outsell its cousin.
And a neat interior on that one, too, way up from the old one.
But, and we benchmarked everything about everybody. And we can't hit everything because we had aggressive aero targets. We had aggressive packaging targets. So, but the car for the customer, most people in this segment, you know, drive the car themselves. This is a personal vehicle. It's not like it is in other countries. You know, most people aren't toting a full-size family. It's either the end of family formation or before family formation. Most people get SUVs in the U.S. if you're worried about packing a bunch of people. So it's a personal touring device. Has to be efficient. Has to look good. Say I've arrived, but not break the bank. You know, So we tried to balance all those things.
And the timelessness is, so you didn't want to do any styling tricks or Baroque
I don't need to.
Surfaces.
When you look at the customer, they're not looking for that. You look at the cars that do well in the segment, they're handsome vehicles. Don't need to make a spectacle out of yourself. I mean, some people live in the city. They don't want to be making noises, but it has to look like, hey, it's worth something. The car really looks appealing, and the details are minded. It's the kind of vehicle you behold it over time, and you see the loving fit and finish details. That's where the value comes from.
And so I'm going to ask a question I've asked of many Chrysler people, and no one's given me an answer, and you probably won't either, but I'm going to ask it. Is there going to be a Dodge counterpart to this
car? No, we're trying to checkerboard our portfolio. You know, in the past, we always had a kind of a, you know, I would say the Charger and 300 are very successful, very different. They attract different customers, different DNA in terms of aggression of the vehicles and whatever. It's a bit different in this segment. We don't need to do that. You know, the Dart is actually the cousin of this vehicle. It's one class smaller. It's a different proposition. So we're trying to see what we can do to make each brand have its own relevant product.
That's good. So, that's gutsy.
Is that a good answer?
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. I finally got one.
Because think about it. You know, 5 years ago, we had standalone Dodge stores. You know, actually 6 years ago. Now we're pretty much all, we call them CJDRs, where all the brands are under one roof. So you don't need to. You know?
And we're sort of sad to see the Sebring 200 convertible go away. Mm. No convertible. Now is the time to make the Challenger or whatever its replacement is have a convertible.
Duly noted. Yeah.
Speaking of the details, so on the chat room, SRT fan wants to know if there are any Easter eggs or little details that you guys hid on this car.
The most prominent one is in the center bin. Underneath the bin, there's a beautiful silhouette of this Detroit City Line, you know, because we're very proud of where we come from. You know.
Minus one thing, though.
That was a joke. It's hilarious. And we'll see who noticed, you know, but we're looking at the more vintage City Line.
Yeah, and just to let everybody else in know, the General Motors building is a very prominent part of the Detroit skyline.
You mean the Renaissance?
And when you the Renaissance.
The Renaissance
Center. Yeah, right. So when you see that, and Chip's got it on the camera now, it's a little hard to see, but, you know, if you see that City Line, there ain't no GM building in it.
We thought we'd have a little fun with that.
See, and that's another interesting aspect.
It's our competitive side. You know, we couldn't help ourselves.
How you guys were able to do the packaging because you have that 9-speed transmission with the rotary.
It's all electronic. There's no cables, nothing.
Yeah, so you have that space there that you can work with.
Yeah, and it's lit. There's a little lit, and there's a pass-through for cables if you want to put something there. Mm-hmm. A lot of cubbies, a lot of clever storage. We've always had that knack for packaging, you know, hiding little clever storage bins, so.
But going back to Gary's question about the little Easter eggs, we found that intriguing that on, what is it, the Cherokee, right?
Yeah.
That you've hidden all these little design icons.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't even found them yet.
Oh, that's the whole point. We don't want to tell you where they are. Over time, you know, enjoy the car.
And you guys have done a good job.
And there's a bit of a social media thing where people say, hey, I found another one, you know. And even on the,
I'll
tell you, a very obvious one on the underhood, the radiator cover is actually a Chrysler wing. No, that was, hey, why not, right? So it's a beautifully, it's abstracted, but when you look back, you're like, wait a minute, that's a Chrysler wing, you know, so have a little fun.
I like that, you know, that brings fun back into mm-hmm. owning a car and discovering things over.
Well, you guys must have a ball doing it, though.
Yeah, we want to tell the customer that we're humans. You know, we love this stuff. We truly love design. There's other things you could do as an artist, right? But to be a car designer, it's not as easy as it used to be. It's
and
not,
that stuff is something you know, the Americans do that the Asians don't really do.
Yeah.
You know, we did drive this car against some of the competition, and you got out of this one thinking there's a lot more personality in this, and the Fusion, really.
Yeah.
Compared to the Accord and the Camry, and they had an Altima there. Those were just much more sterile and austere and maybe more refined and maybe a little bit quieter. But
and Frank hit on it. You know, that we tried to give the car a little, you know, the engineers gave it a nice exhaust tone, especially with the V6, 295 horse, most powerful V6 in the class. The all-wheel drive system has a rear bias. In the snowy days, I had mine driving around. It'll actually, you know, throttle steer, which is unusual in this class. So
we're fabulous.
So someone who's coming from, you know, maybe a driver's car in his past, they'll love it, you know. So.
I thought there should have been more note on the V6. I honestly thought that.
Even more?
Even more.
We try to find the right balance between.
You know.
Hey, wait, Chip's going to bring up this, the Chrysler Wing that's on the radiator.
Yeah, I want to see it.
See it, the abstracted one?
See it there, yeah.
There you go. See, there it is. Ta-da.
Yeah, look at that.
It's abstracted, you know.
Yeah.
That's our Jeff Hamoud, our designer. So we get into the underhood, right? People don't realize we designed the engine cover, all that stuff. And there's seals everywhere, so to make it clean. You know, it's not. When you open the hood, you look like someone cared. It just wasn't schlocked together, you know.
Yeah, the old term, because was probably not until the 1980s that automakers, Audi, of mass manufacturers, mm-hmm. was the first to do that. And somebody came up with the term explosion in a spaghetti factory. That's what the underhood used to look like. It was just wires. And
the irony is nowadays you rarely open the hood anymore. But you know.
Hey, in the winter, washer fluid needs to be refilled.
Yeah, that's right.
Once a month or more. So
yeah, might as well enjoy it.
Yeah.
But that presumably takes more time for your team to do that. I mean, isn't there pressure to reduce the amount of time?
There is, but there's an interesting thing that's going on. It's a competition, right? So one studio does that, and the other one goes, wait a minute, I want to have fun too. So it becomes this a little bit of an internal competition. You know, how can we? I actually had to stop the Easter egg thing because it was getting out of control. I was like, wait a minute. They're everywhere. Stop. It's not fun anymore. And on the Viper, we had a little Nürburgring thing in the where a little abstraction of the Nürburgring, and some owner thought it was a problem with the molding. Didn't understand what that was. And once they found out, oh, it's a Nürburgring, I would love it. It's the greatest thing.
Yeah. But,
so
great.
So not everyone.
Worm crawled up in the
not everyone
in the
gets it, you know. So anyway.
So, yeah, you brought up the Viper. What can you tell us? I mean, you know.
You know, I'm amazed for a vehicle that sells, you know, it's never sold more than 1,500 a year, 2,000 a year. I can't believe how much the world is writing about it. You'd think it's, you know, it's a 15 million unit market, and everyone's talking about this Viper, which is good. Good for us, because that means the awareness is really high. There's a lot of confusion about the car. You know, we probably made the mistake. I said I want to sell between 1,500 and 2,000 last year. We didn't really launch any serious volume until midsummer. So we only had 6 months last year. We sold, to date, worldwide about 700 cars. Now, at first, yeah, it's less than our target, but the good news is we're getting 60% conquest. People that have never come to our brand ever before are considering the Viper. And that's what our research was telling us. If you put a nicer interior, if you give it a better fit and finish, we'll come look at it. And our existing owners are starting to kind of pick up steam. Our 14s are selling really quick. We have a little bit of leftover 2013s, but most of those cars were ordered by dealers. And they were GTSs, so very high-end vehicles. Average price was about $140,000, fully optioned. And our owners are saying, no, if I want a car, I'm going to order it and wait. So that's what's happening. People are putting orders in. We actually have orders to fill our plants, but I can't do that to the dealers that already have stock. So I'm pulling back production on purpose to let this burn down. We've had a wicked winter. It's actually hurt sales. Now the spring has come. We're 30% up this month over last month already. We expected it because every year it's the same pattern, but we missed it last year. The Viper has not enjoyed a natural spring. So we're gonna see what happens. We'll get rid of the old stock to happy people. One by one, I get letters every day. People love their car. They're surprised. Why do they wait so long? So it's taking time. You can't jump up to that echelon of car and expect to sell them, you know, like hotcakes. It just doesn't happen at that price point. The good news is we're outselling our competitors. I mean, if you look at cars in the $100,000 to $140,000 range, we're doing really well. Hmm. But people think of us as a Corvette competitor. Well, we have 240 horsepower more or 220 horsepower more. It's just not the same machine. Ours is more of an exotic, something you drive on Saturdays and Sundays. You're not going to see, you know, there's stores in Dearborn here that have 200 Corvettes in the lot. You'll never see that. Mm-hmm. You'll see one or two Vipers per dealer, and that's all that's out there. Everyone imagines they're stockpiled, and a lot of dealers have them roped off. They'll never sell them. You know? So I'm not so worried. I mean, it could be a little better, but it's picking up steam nicely, and I'm really proud of what the car's become.
Is there an ideal number in your mind for what that should be on an annual basis?
Not really. I mean, like I said, it's ebbed and flowed as low as 500 cars a year to as much as 1,500. What's happening, too, is we're getting requests for special colors. People have been waiting for the green. We just launched a green, orders through the roof for the green. The TA, we left a big hole when the ACR was out of production. We have a very track-oriented customer. They're loving the TA. The TLRs are flying. I mean, less than 30 days on the lot. So certain units, the ones that kind of hit the heartstrings, are going very, very well. It's just the cars that the dealers ordered that weren't ordered for anyone. They were ordered as if you were ordering a Ram truck and you put it in stock. That's not the way so we're educating ourselves. We had to learn a lesson there, and our dealers are learning as well.
So when somebody's spending that kind of money, they have very specific ideas in mind of what they want to spend their money
on.
Exactly.
And to put it in perspective,
that one.
Last year we had 2,000 orders for Vipers, and I refused to build them. They're saying, no way can the market handle 2,000 cars like that. So we didn't. We've built half of that on purpose.
Wow.
So people confuse that as, oh, it's not. No, it's self. We are trying to.
I'm impressed. That's a lot of discipline.
Yeah, we're trying to control the value to make sure it's special. It's not a, stockpile them car. So.
What about the criticism that there has been insufficient world competition to get enough, of that competition history out there to sell in Europe and elsewhere? Mm-hmm. And then now we hear that we're pulling out of Le Mans.
Yeah, and that was a budgetary thing. So, again, my budget from last year was carryover. Same, we didn't get any up, so I have a fixed budget. The Tudor Series is fantastic, but they've added 30 hours of racing this year. Two more endurance races, not just heat races. Endurance races are very expensive to run, so I just couldn't afford to go to Le Mans. Now, we thought we'd get invited, but we weren't sure. We got invited. We never accepted the invitation because we weren't sure, and we finally had to discuss it with the ACO and say, we just can't swing it this year. And my focus is on winning. It's a big, you're over there for a month. Le Mans is not, hop on a plane and go. You're there for a month. You're testing all month. You're moving 42 people over there for a whole month, paying hotels. It's the cost of one Le Mans race is like 4 months of racing in the normal series. So it's a big deal, and we're just not there yet. We want to focus on the U.S. market, try to win the championship this year, and we'll see what the future holds.
And you got second place at Sebring.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's a huge step up.
Podium twice.
We
got third place in Daytona, so we're off to a good start. And we had a flawless race at Sebring, not a mistake. We had the lowest time in the pit of any team. So we used to be the Jamaican bobsledders. Our pit stops were comical last year. We were dropping tools, and the guys were trying. Because a lot of these guys, they have normal jobs. One guy's an exec at this company and that, and they just come and do this for fun. They don't get paid much to do it. They just do it for fun as a hobby. So this year, everybody's tightened way up.
Yeah. How's the rest of SRT doing?
Really well. Last year, we exceeded our world targets by about 1,000 units. So we did really well. The Grand Cherokee, I can't keep them in stock. They're really hot, and we're seeing a new customer we've never seen. And that's the thing about SRT. We've been patient, controlling volume again. Yeah, they're a little more expensive, but we have to regulate the volume. If I lowered the price, I'd sell too many, and the cafe would be out of whack. So I have to find the perfect balance. The Grand Cherokee's doing well. Charger's picking up, and the Challenger, again, with spring coming, the sales are up considerably this spring already.
Is SRT outside of the U.S. market?
Yeah. We sell the Grand Cherokee in Europe, all over the world. We sell the 300 in the Middle East and Australia because it's right-hand drive available, as well as the Grand Cherokee. Mm. And in the Middle East, we have a full complement of everything we see in the States, we sell in the Middle East because they have the same legal requirements as we do. So. They love the Charger there, by the way. It's one of their favorite vehicles.
Hey, look, we got all kinds of questions coming in from the audience.
Bring it.
Here. Yeah. Hey, Ben, let's get to rapid fire.
Oh, boy. What is that? Who is that guy?
That's actually Jason Vines.
Oh, okay. I know him. We used to work together.
Jonathan One wants to know, does anyone at SRT ever dream of a supercharged V8 Hemi Viper?
That's a question that, ever since this story about a certain feline thing has been talked about, there's been discussion about putting the Hemi in the, it won't fit. So the Hemi, the Viper engine is based off an older designed V8, a 90-degree V8 with very small heads, a pushrod V8, obviously. So the frame is built right to the engine. It's very tight packaging. We cannot physically fit the Hemi in the, or any engine for that matter. We've looked at double overhead cam V8s, way too wide for that package. So it really, the V10 is about it that fits in that platform.
Interesting. Wright Knight says, will the next or future Gen 200 go rear wheel drive as the Chrysler brand moves upscale to compete with Cadillac someday?
Okay. Has he been paying attention? We just launched this 200. Spent quite a bit of dosh on this car. I don't think we're going to worry about the future just yet. So stand pat. But it drives, I tell you what, the 295 horse V6 all-wheel drive drives a lot more rear drive than you'd think. A lot, it goes 80% rear under full power, under certain in sport mode. So.
JM1NB asks, did you drop Le Mans to go to Targa Newfoundland?
No. Targa Newfoundland is like a $30,000 exercise compared to a $2.5 million exercise. No comparison.
And he's just curious. And this is interesting because I've had other people ask me, are there still products or parts in the pipeline that are from the Mercedes days?
And virtually none. I mean, in the Grand Cherokee, there's a few steering racks that we co-source. They're not really, they were actually developed together. And we use common suppliers on a few things, but that's about it. Everything has moved on.
Okay, here's one for Frank and Gary probably. What happens, this is AAH guest 073. What happens at a Tesla store when you want to trade in a car? How's a trade-in handled, assuming that they take a trade?
Good question.
I think you're SOL.
But they don't have stores, though. That's the whole point. So basically, the way the galleries work now is that you go to one of these places, or it could be in a shopping mall.
It's like buying a smartphone.
Well, but you go buy it on a computer terminal, and you're buying it from the factory. So you're not actually buying it.
Shipped to your house or something.
So you're not buying it from them. But
sell it on Craigslist yourself. You'll get more money for it anyway.
I'm sure that's probably the model they're thinking of. And you know, didn't he make his money on PayPal?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just want to know, where do you go to get it serviced or repaired? Anyway, we'll let that go for another show. Miradart from Twitter writes in to ask if an SRT4 Dart were to be made, what current car would be your bogey to beat, as in unacceptable to be behind?
So that's a good question, because we've actually been asked that. I put that out to my Twitter world months ago, and they all came back, well, we want something with 300 horsepower, four-wheel drive. So quite a leap from where we've been. I mean, if you remember, the original car was 215 horsepower front-wheel drive, very economical package. So it sounds like the people out there want a Subaru STI Fighter, Mitsubishi Evo, which is, those cars, if you looked at their pricing, has come into the close to $40,000 range. So that's almost double where we've been before. So very intriguing. The problem with that is the air is quite thin there. You know, there's a lot of enthusiasts that want that, but it's hard to make a business case.
They want to buy it 3 years old, used.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
So we'll see. I think there's a lot of
Craigslist.
You know, no shortage of enthusiasts inside Chrysler. So we'll see.
Hey,
stay tuned.
We've got a number of phone calls here. So, Ben, let's bring in one of those phoners.
And these aren't even
Hi, guys.
Screens.
This is Auto Freelancer from New Jersey.
Wow.
I want to say brilliant show, guys, and keep up the good work. And, Ralph, you're doing great things at Chrysler, and your passion for what you do really shows. I have a two-part question. First, Ralph, do you remember back in the 80s, Dodge had a mid-engine prototype sports car called the M4S Turbo Interceptor? It was featured in the movie called The Wraith and had a Cosworth engine.
Yep.
Well, my second question is, could SRT revive the M4S borrowing the architecture from the new Alpha 4C to make an affordable mid-engine sports car? There are a lot of car enthusiasts that want a mid-engine sports car but can't afford a Porsche or Lotus, and SRT would be the perfect brand for such a car. Thanks, guys. And your thoughts?
That's a very good question. I remember that car. The show didn't do too well. But when I look at our portfolio, I look at, you know, I'm the same way as our consumer. I look at what can I buy? It has to be within the company. I look at the Alpha 4C as something, hey, you know, I could potentially buy that. So in a way, if Alpha's got it covered, we don't want to crowd their airspace. You know, that's Alpha's territory. It's their platform now. Longer term, as a company, we probably should look at that. Why not? You know, I think the SRT brand or the SRT idea is very transferable. We can do a lot of things, and I think this future of performance is wide open. So I would never say never to that. But in the meantime, I think the 4C is a fantastic vehicle, and I hope people, if they're looking for that sort of car, go buy that. You know?
Would it be possible for you guys to execute a just pure SRT car?
Well, the Vipers.
Well, but I mean, but came from Dodge Viper, and so
I don't know. There. We'll see. The time, you know, it's interesting. I've thought about that all. I have dreams like that. You're crawling into my head now. But it's tough. I'd say, to be honest with you, the company has a lot of priorities right now. You know, we're if you look at what we're doing, we're building plants, we're building brand new platforms, brand new cars, doing merging two companies together. There's a lot of priorities. So I don't think it's, everyone thinks we can just make cars by snapping our fingers. It's not so easy. Mm-hmm. You know.
Hey, we got another phoner here, Ben. Let's bring that one in.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan out in Old Japan. Listen, The reason the Viper's got a 412-day supply is Sergio decided to charge all SRT Viper dealers $25,000 to distribute the car. They decided to hit that $25,000 on the first car that hit in its entirety. So the guys that came in that were all hot in Vipers, all my buddies that had bets and went to Vipers, were ready to buy the new Viper, went in, car was roped off, they were told they weren't allowed to sit in it, and then they would be in charge an extra $25,000 marketed just besides the increase in the MSRP.
Yeah,
Sergio screwed the pooch.
Easy. Hold on a second. It's not that clear. So it wasn't his decision. It actually was the network development team. And the reason and that's a small amount of money. They got a lot for that money, by the way. With this, four people went to Detroit, got trained heavily, three-day training, actually in a race type. They actually got to drive the car in a race environment, got to talk to engineers, go to the wind tunnel. It was a very deep training. The other thing is tools. The vehicle has new tools that they had to buy, new things. So they didn't just pay $20,000 for nothing or $25,000. The other thing was we have 2,300 stores. So if every store wanted a Viper, it'd be impossible. So by charging a certain hurdle rate, it allows us to pare it down. Even then, 443 stores is probably too much as well. So he's right. There was definitely, there's one guy, the record was one gentleman in Atlanta tried to charge $100,000 over sticker for his car. So clearly an inexperienced, someone who doesn't believe the internet exists apparently. So all that behavior has come and gone, thankfully, and they learned their lesson and are getting back to reality. But unfortunately, it did taint the water in the beginning. And our dealers, I'll give you an example. Out of the 700 cars we sold, one-third of that volume was done by three dealers. And there are dealers that have never sold a car above MSRP. So they treat their customers right, and they get the spoils.
You know, it's all when you do that, when you treat your customer right, boy, doesn't everything else fall into place.
Yeah.
Let's bring in another phoner here, Ben.
Good evening, John. Hey, this is Mark Bird calling from Hanson, Virginia. The question here is for Ralph. Is the SRT division going to get the Dart platform, and when can we look for that in the dealer showroom? Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
So very good question. Again, it comes back to expectations. When the Dart was born a few years back, we didn't have a powertrain that fit in terms of creating, let's say, minimum 250 horsepower, right? So we are developing a new family of four-cylinder engines, but we're between the current family of engines and the new ones. So if we were to launch something now, we'd have a one-and-a-half-year lifespan. So we have some brand-new powertrains coming in the future, and the timing just wasn't right. So it's one of those things, do it right or don't do it at all. So
Eric Ambrose says, Ralph, I would say designing normal parts with design in mind is faster and better value than designing to a cost, and goes on to say he's a materials engineer. I guess he's, what's your thoughts?
I agree. I mean, I think a well-designed part, the cost is not everything, you know, because sometimes you can under-design a part and have to pay for it later with repairs. I think if you design a part efficiently, you shouldn't have to design any more cost than required. So it's an art, but luckily at a company our size, we're getting into platform sharing. You know, the three vehicles off this platform, the Cherokee, the Dart, and the 200, great efficiencies underneath the skin. And a good part can be, again, reused with no degradation in vehicle character. So there's a lot to it, and that's what we do for a living.
How about taking it to things like, as they do in boats, hinges, striker plates? Well, they don't have
We're doing that. It's funny you mention that. We're doing door handles are common below the surface. The screen, the famous 8-4 screen, is just about half of our product now. That's all common. The clusters look
different. No, but I'm not talking about commonality. I'm talking about designing, not just making a hinge that works functionally perfectly. But when you open the door, instead of seeing bolts and flanges and stuff,
it
looks beautiful, right?
Yeah, there's a point where the cost goes through the roof.
You know? Well, to be fair,
I think you're talking a Bentley on Osh or something like that.
You open the trunk of that car. I mean, it looks a hell of a lot better than if we were to look at the trunk from 10 years ago. I mean, you guys clearly
it's all finished and,
and paid attention to something that you could very easily say, ah, never mind.
And even simple mundane thing underneath the car body sealer. It's all robotically applied. It's perfect. It's not, you know, spatula applied. So
yeah,
there's things like that.
And it's rotisserie when it goes through there, so gravity helps it too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That plant is amazing.
Yeah, I got to get in there.
It's cool. The Schaap plant is unbelievable.
Yeah.
You missed your chance. They don't do tours.
Boy, I'll bet you.
For him?
It was decades ago. They'll put me to work on the line if I go there. Ben, let's bring in the next phoner here.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. I would be curious to know for Ralph if he had a budget of no greater than $40,000 and could not buy a Chrysler Group product, what new vehicle would be on a short list to buy?
I would probably buy a an FRS or a BRZ. I love those little cars.
That's a and $40,000 to give you some headroom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and I,
power.
Yeah,
you could
get go spend another $20,000 to get, because it's a little underpowered, but I love the chassis on that vehicle.
I think for...
I don't like the way it looks, but I like the way it drives.
Yeah, I like the way it drives on a track.
Yeah.
For everyday commuting, ooh, that car will beat you up.
That's my fun side. My practical side, I don't know, that's a very, very good question. I like the Mazda 3 a lot,
Yeah.
I like the Ford ST. I think it's a great package car.
A blast.
Fun little
for
car.
For the
I'd have to get it in a color that wasn't
Fiesta.
Too loud.
Yeah. Almost more fun than the Focus.
Yeah.
And at $40,000, you could almost buy two STs. So, yeah.
But
there's some good stuff out there.
Yeah.
Ben, let's bring in the next one.
This is D500, Franklin, Tennessee. I wanted to ask your guest if the Chrysler 300 diesel will be available in the 2015 model year with all-wheel drive. Thank you.
I would say I'm not supposed to talk about future product, but that's safe to say no on that one. but we do have a diesel Grand Cherokee, which is picking up steam nicely. 3 liter diesel, phenomenal machine, 8-speed transmission, great fuel economy. It's
how,
a little.
Are those selling the diesel?
I don't know yet. I'm not sure about that. But I know they just launched.
Mm-hmm.
I know the truck is back ordered big time.
No kidding.
The Ram with the similar powertrain is really, really doing well. So.
Yeah, I've been tracking diesels a lot and. Volkswagen does a hell of a good job in the American market selling diesel.
And when someone asks a question like that, I know the Passat community, the Volkswagen, they're fuel economy, obsessed, right? So I don't know if they're aware of the V6 8-speed. The 3.6 Pentastar with the 8-speed in that very low-drag 300 gets easily 30, 31 miles per gallon.
When does the transmission capacity come up to where you can have the V8? 8-speed in that car. I was trying to. My dad was holding out for that, and I finally said, "Dad, just get the 6. You'll be fine." It's been fine, but and actually, we should throw out. Just today, we found out 23 and 36 on the 4-cylinder.
Yep, we have 36 on the 4-cylinder, 32 on the front drive V6, and 29 on the all-wheel drive V6, which is pretty good.
That's pretty good. That is
right amongst the best.
Carl Esposito wants to know: will there be an S package available for the 200
at launch? Matter of fact, the car is launching in two different flavors. So this is a C in the studio, and the S model is available in front wheel drive and all wheel drive. The V6 and all wheel drive are always mated together, and it's the most powerful car in the class. So if you like that look, it comes with the black, virtually no chrome on the vehicle, very kind of subdued, pretty neat package available with 19-inch wheels. As
sinister.
Well. Yeah,
he's got a follow-up, too, that's really better for Frank or Gary. He says, will a sporty version of the Honda Fit be available?
Mm-hmm.
Not to my knowledge.
No SI has ever been on that platform. I think you'd find that hybrid would feel mighty sporty. Hmm. Yeah, bring that up.
I can't imagine that they would, maybe late in its life.
Who knows?
Marco Morella wants to know, any plans to offer a smaller, lighter weight coupe with a Hemi V8 to better compete with the new Mustang Camaro? Would love to see modern styling in a smaller package than the current Challenger.
Can't talk about future product.
Yeah. It's my job to ask the question.
He didn't rule that one out, though, did he?
No, he did not. That's right. SRT fan wants to know, does the new CLA AMG 355 horsepower 4-cylinder challenge you to work your SRT goodness onto something?
I'm fascinated by that car. It's pretty neat. That car on many fronts is impressive for Mercedes-Benz, being a front drive type architecture, small displacement, same with the TT. There's a big movement to these hyper low displacement, high power turbo engines, So we're watching that carefully.
George from Harrison Township, I kind of like how that goes together, George Harrison. Anyway, he's wondering how the new car design process works. This is a good question.
Yeah.
He says, does one person have total creative control on the exterior of a vehicle, or is it more of a group of designers? And he goes on to say, like on the new 200, who had the final say on the design?
So there's a difference between say and... Okay, so I'll give you how it works. So typically, when I set out a project, so the brand or the boss asks for a car, or in this case, we knew we were going to replace the 200. Say, okay, let's sketch on the 200. Here's the package is fairly defined by the product planning team and the engineering. And then we sketch away the entire, typically, sometimes if it's an important car, I open it up to the entire studio. So all of my designers, we have about 75, 80 designers will sketch on it. And I kind of do the initial paring down, and typically it'll end up with three or four competing models. And then finally one design will win out. In the case of the 200, we had Jeff Hammoud and Jeff Narrows, two designers. One had the front end, the rest had the rest of the car. They worked together. And I'm more like a movie director. Brandon Froat, who runs the studio, and myself, we're kind of like, I don't sketch anymore, sadly. I doodle once in a while just to kind of make my point. And then we'll bring it to the boss. So the boss will kind of have the papal blessing. But that's how it works. It's really simple. Hmm. And then the designer keeps iterating. The part no one talks about, once the glamour is over with, we're noodling that car for 6-8 months in design office. You know, and the interior is the same way. It's a pared-down process. Kind of a best person wins, best designer wins.
How much do you involve engineering and manufacturing so that...
Daily. And then one thing...
So that you're not constantly going, we got to change this.
Even before the vehicle is finalized, we give them we have a pretty good idea what the silhouette will be. We'll hand that over. Then as it's refined, we'll hand it over. And we have a process at Chrysler. Once we get, we get into the digital phase, they have access to that data anytime they want to. So they're constantly cutting sections and saying, hey, this is unfeasible, or this is feasible, or this is going to cause this to move around the engine compartment. And that's when one of our advantages are we have a freakishly good relationship with engineering. There's no animosity. You've heard of the classic engineering design battles. I honestly, in the last 10 years of my career at Chrysler, I've never seen it. I don't know what people are talking about, because we chuck beers together, we have a good time, and we just make it happen. There's no time for fighting. You
know? The way it should happen.
Yeah.
Robert wants to know, any possibility we might ever see an SRT minivan?
I built my own years ago. You know, I remember having an argument with product planning guys. I said, Ralph, you're probably the only person who wants one, you know. But I would say the van I built on my own, I put Viper brakes on it, had competition seats. I used to take it to, I had kids, so that's the only car I had at the time. I would go to driver's schools and have fun with it. But today's van is faster than what I had. The 283-horse minivan is nothing to sneeze at. But yeah, so the Dodge Caravan with the black interior is about as close as it gets for now.
Man van.
The man van.
SRT Geek says, I'm going to buy a Challenger Hellcat regardless, but any chance we'll see the Hellcat in the Jeep SRT?
Can't talk about future product.
Yeah. All right. Let's see.
How this kitty thing, I can't say the word legally. I'll tell people why, because there's a certain motorcycle company that owns that name. And he's actually a friend of mine, the guy who owns a company, so maybe we can negotiate. But it's interesting. It's folklore. It's become quite powerful. It's a code name that we use internally, and it's become kind of bigger than us at this point, so it's interesting.
It's a great name. Hellcat?
What are you talking about?
It's a great name. It was a great fighter plane, too.
Yeah, it was.
Hey, Ben, we got more phoners coming in. Let's bring one in here.
That's a little Chrysler thing. All of our engine programs are named after airplanes. Yeah.
Oh.
Airplanes of war, warships.
Yeah. So.
Apache and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yes, this is Mark Gongel from Troy, Michigan. I have a question for Ralph. Are there any future plans to build a automatic Viper? Thank you.
So I would lie to you if I didn't say I thought about it. When we initially looked at it, nobody made a transmission that could handle our torque in the package that we have. And we looked at these manumatic things. Didn't work very well. Aston has had a hell of a time.
Shift like
they crap. Only work on the track when you're going really, all the way down, full throttle. But in terms of city driving, useless. So we focused on a very, very nice snickety-snick transmission. And that's the thing about the Viper. It's a visceral machine. I like to think of it as maybe it's a holdout. I don't know. But it's one of the few vehicles that you truly, truly drive. And the people that own them, everyone says it's scary. It's not scary. If you learn to drive the car and enjoy it, it's every time. I've driven them 15 years, and I still, the hair on the neck goes up when you start it. It's just, you're about to have an adventure. It's not a passive machine. And if you want an automatic car, there's plenty of them out there. We just can't find anything that fits in our package. Our engine splinters all of them.
Which part of your job you like better? I mean, you're really passionate about SRT, and yet you're doing fabulous designs. Which is...
Design is still my, I've always been a car guy since I was able to point at a car and say I love cars. So that's just who I am. And I think a lot of designers love cars. Go to car shows, tinker, I wrench. I still have grease under my fingernails from taking my transmission out of my car. Just love it. But design is my main job. I spend 80% of my time in the design office. I love it. Will always love it. It's they're inseparable. They're together. And I may not always run SRT. We have to rotate. There'll be other people that come and go that run the brand, but I hope kind of put it in a good place. But the design is who I am. I hope to design until I can't do it anymore.
This may not be the right question for you, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It's a good question. Tim Beaumont wants to know, why does Chrysler not take advantage of the extensive European knowledge and experience of Fiat regarding CNG?
Who says we're not? We just don't talk about it, but it's timing is everything. You know, the infrastructure is a big part of it. I'm not an expert. That's probably a question for Bob Lee. We've done quite a bit of that with the Ram truck. We have some fleet Rams that are CNG,
right?
Very successful. So
the only thing that's waiting for that is there are a lot of technologies in the works to shrink those tanks and make them easier to pack it.
Yeah, cheaper.
You can do it in Rams because you can fit tubes somewhere, but yeah, there are people working on these intestinal
liquefied
things and whatever that you can package in a regular car. And when those start to hit, we'll probably see it.
The suck, squeeze, blow part of it's easy. You know, it's the packaging, and as a packaging engineer, he knows what the problem is.
That's right.
Yeah. No, there's some company up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan working on extruded aluminum CNG tanks.
Yeah, where you put it in the
frame.
That
are not cylindrical. They're rectangular. So. Yeah.
And you could pressurize the aperture of the vehicle. Why not, right? So
ooh,
the old drag racing trick, putting fuel in the rail. You know?
Oh, there you go. Ben, we got a few more phoners. Let's bring one in.
Hey, guys. This is Youngblood calling from Cleveland, Ohio.
These are great names, by the way. Youngblood.
Any chance in the near future there might be an SRT version of the Ram 1500 diesel? Thank you.
Wow.
Ooh, that could be
I think I'm going to start a private equity company that raises money for all these things, because these are great ideas, you know, the diesel Ram SRT. I have to admit, I've never thought of that one. It's a pretty interesting idea. We have a small, probably about 15,000 truck owners out there that ask this all the time.
How about a Grand Cherokee SRT diesel? That would go over Europe, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Can't talk about future product.
That's right.
And all you guys phoning in, I can't talk about future product. That's a rule. We just don't talk about future product.
And that's true throughout the industry, not just with you, right?
It would hurt our dealers. It would hurt future business.
So. Yep. Okay, Ben, let's bring in the next phone call.
Hi, this is Scott from California. I was at SpringFest 9 last week and actually got to see Ralph and his team getting pretty excited about the Hellcat production coming up here pretty soon. My question for Ralph is the car going to be available with the shaker hood for the car? Is the car going to have a shaker hood option?
You want me to answer that?
Supercharged shaker hood.
I can't talk about that.
Thanks, bye.
Why? I wish I could.
Everybody knows about the Hellcat.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? Well, I didn't help matters by wearing I changed my avatar on my Twitter yesterday to the Kit Kat thing. stay tuned. We don't like to leave the cat out of the bag, so to speak.
He didn't deny it. Okay. We got one more phone call, and then we'll be wrapping up. So, Ben, let's bring that in.
Good evening, John, Gary, and Ralph. How are you? This is Robert from Katz's Deli in New York City calling. I just wanted to let you know that we sent you a nice little care package for you guys to enjoy and to welcome Gary as your new co-host, John.
Katz?
And wish you all the best, Gary, in your new role. And also just wanted to let Ralph know that there's a little special package for him as well. Hope that he enjoys. And Ralph, as usual, we appreciate all you do for the SRT community and Chrysler folks, and we really like your product and wish you the best in the future. And enjoy the food. Thanks again. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you very much.
I got to tell you this story. So two years ago, we went to the New York Auto Show, and we were hungry, and one of my designers went to a famous Katz Deli. So if anyone's seen Harry Met Sally, was it Harry Met Sally?
No.
Harry Met Sally, famous scene where she's enjoying
faking the orgasm.
Meg Ryan.
You can say that on this?
Okay. Yeah, we can say it.
Faking the orgasm. Yeah, exactly. That's where it was filmed. Yeah. So ever since then, his place, it always was there. It's a family business, been around since 1888. So it's been around a long time. But obviously, it's never been the same ever since. And I went there myself and met Rob, who owns the restaurant. Still works every day, works his butt off.
And a real car guy.
I found out he's a Mopar freak.
Yeah.
He's got all kinds of Mopars. He's got Vipers as well. And he was, I believe, the first one. He ordered a TA, the new TA, and I made sure he was the first one to ever get it.
No
So
kidding.
He has a brand new orange TA. He got it during the winter, unfortunately, so it's in storage probably. But he loved the car. He saw it in the Motor Trend piece and just had to have it, you know, so he was number one. And thank you. He doesn't have to do this, but I love his...
I know. We love it. They've been big fans of the show here. Yeah.
Let's wrap this up and dig in.
Yeah. We've got corned beef and pastrami here, and the stuff is killer. And just before the holidays, they sent us a beautiful cheesecake, too. So it's an awesome place.
So only thing I'd like to say to, to people out there is we're really excited. We hear you. I mean, I was at Springfest, and it was... every 30 seconds asking about the future. So many people are excited about the future of the company in general, but the SRT brand. And we're trying our best. I mean, it's not easy to do these kind of cars in this headwind. You know, it's very challenging times. Fuel economy is always front and center, and that's the priority is the main business. But, you know, there's a lot of enthusiastic people at Chrysler still trying to keep cars fun and exciting.
It shows. It really does. So thanks for coming on the show. Awesome. We love the fact that we were able to get a 200 in the studio here with us, too.
Awesome.
So, Frank Marcus, I know we got to cut you loose. You've got to go rehearse for your play.
That's right.
People don't know this, but here's a, well, I was about to say a frustrated actor, but not frustrated actor. He's just an actor.
Once in a while. You never
and newly married. Congratulations.
Oh, yes. Thank you. There at the Farmington Players. Yeah. April 25th. Rumors. Neil Simon, if you're local.
Awesome.
That's great. Well, thanks for coming along.
All right.
And Gary, good seeing you as always.
Seeing you, John.
So
here, there.
Everywhere. Yeah. There's a song. Never mind. We're not going to go down that path. Not now, at least. Want to thank everybody else for having tuned in. Remember, tell your friends and everyone else. It's on our website. It's on YouTube. Go out and check it out. And you can always listen to it in your car, streaming it through your phone. So there's a lot of ways to get the show. We'll see you next week.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.